Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times and David Priest, goalkeeper, columnist, podcaster. Three lions on the shirt, jewels remain still gleaming. You know the rest. 52 years of hurt and all that. It's that time again when hope meets expectation and hype meets reality. What should we expect from England in this World Cup? That's the question, Johnny.
Well, I mean, you talk about expectation, Mike. I mean, I think that expectations are more realistic than they've been. Probably my experience of covering England, which stretches back to the 98 tournament. I think the last eight would be accepted and it would be a good result for England. Last 16 would almost be sort of par. I know that as the tournament gets closer, there are a few who are starting to feel those odd flickers of optimism and think about doing more than that. I just don't think that's realistic at England's sort of level at the moment. However, you've always got to say that Portugal winning Euro 2016, Denmark, you know, blah, 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 it can happen. England have certainly got players who can damage opponents on their day, they can score goals. But a few things would have to go in England's favour, and it would essentially have to be a tournament where the big teams, you know, big heavyweight teams in World Cup terms didn't turn up. So all of that last eight, probably penalty shootout. There we go.
You know, if you look at it from the outside looking in, David, you know, say this team was, I don't know, Peru, you'd think not bad, but fair to middling. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think we're probably lacking the real top elite players that can make the difference, you know, once you get into the knockout stages. I think England's problem's obviously going to be the quarterfinal, where all things are going well, that you're looking at someone like Germany in the last eight. Mm. And that's a real barrier to any success they're going to have in the tournament.
Yeah, a Germany team can afford to go into a World Cup without Sane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it just shows how strong they are. I mean, he's probably been one of the top performers of the Premier League this season. And I'm sure he's disappointed. I'm disappointed for him.
Yeah, yeah. What about, you know, how do England prove people wrong? Who are the key individuals who have to almost like go beyond themselves to make England tick?
Well, you're looking at the young players, and the thing that maybe gives England hope is that players can develop quickly at a young age, and you know, a big stage, a big tournament, or you know, a Champions League, that can sometimes just kick someone's development on. So I think they would need Raheem Sterling to deliver more goals, because he's developed a hell of a lot as a player. He's getting in brilliant positions now. I think he's got a good football brain, but if he can add more goals to his game, I think Dele Alli would need to have a big tournament. Obviously, Harry Kane has to shoulder a lot for England. But I also think there's sort of flaws in that England team, maybe at the back and in the sort of wide positions, that would have to be solved by players playing above themselves. So I mean someone like Kieran Trippier, who's a really good Premier League player, but would have to become an international class player. Or a Harry Maguire, who you know, shows glimpses of what he can do, but also tends to play in defences that concede lots of goals at Premier League level. He'd have to sort of kick on a bit. So there's, as I say, a few things have to come together, but they're young players, and young players can develop at speed.
What's your assessment, David, of the goalkeeping situation?
I think it's probably worked out for the best. Gareth said that it's a statement that he's made by playing Jordan in the game at the weekend. I'd imagine he'd play again on Thursday. He needs that game time, needs that understanding of the players in front of him. Also, the team gelling together, you know, get more of an idea of what the starting 11 is going to be when we start the tournament. But when it comes to inexperience, yes, there's not a lot of caps there, especially in, you know, with Nick Pope and Jack Butland as well. But also that I think what you'll see now is now that Joan Pickford's got the backing of the manager, you know, we've been hit by pressures before, and you know, people not being able to cope with the expectations going into tournaments and mistakes happening. What you'll see now from Joan Pickford, you'll just see him grow. He'll just take on the responsibility, and he'll grow in stature. And you can see him on the ball. He wants the ball back to him. There's no trepidation. He wants to be involved. And like I said, they don't give up many chances. You know, so, you know, I know we talk about the number of saves that Butland and Pope have made this season, far superior to Joan Pickford's, but that's not what he's in the team for, and that's not what he's going to bring to the side.
You've seen Jordan Pickford grow, quite literally.
Yeah.
What was the first time you saw him, and what did he strike you as?
I saw him as a 15-year-old at Sunderland, and you could see that the one thing that struck you is just his enthusiasm. You know, he was always a big talker, always a big voice on the side. And then as he's come through the ranks, you know, he's probably, you know, there's been a lot of talk about his professionalism and about his diet, and, you know, he's hit back at things that David Moyes has said there in the past. But he did have a problem with that. You know, he didn't have a problem with training. He didn't have a problem with sort of motivation and working hard. He had that. But he needed the other side, just where he needed, you know, the gym workers was what he needed also because of his body shape and also his diet as well. But all that's coming to it now, and now you're seeing that all come together. And, you know, even looking at him at Alfreton Town in the conference, the confidence he showed playing against, you know, real men and getting battered every week, but he was coming and he was taking everything. And there was one thing that stood out, and Nick Pope as well when he was at Cambridge in York. Mm-hmm. The two of them just had this real confidence that he didn't see, and even in the leagues above him. Mm-hmm. He came for everything, even long throw-ins as well. And sometimes, you know, it cost him a goal or two, but like anything else, like, you know, Grobbelaar in the past, you want people coming in and dominating the box.
Because that's the interesting point, isn't it, Johnny, that this is an England team probably finished off by the Premier League, but it was actually formed by Football League clubs.
Yeah, you can go through most of the starting 11 now, you'd say. If they've either been permanent signings for Football League clubs or even conference clubs, or they've spent, you know, significant periods on loan there, which tells a story about character and personality, and maybe how our Premier League academies aren't really forging that, and these lads that are developing and fighting to the top have started low down. You know, Dele Alli's an obvious example as well, and Pickford, Pope. There's very few that are kind of from the gilded scenario. Even Raheem Sterling, who, you know, has played all this sort of senior football at the top level, but started off at QPR, didn't he, as a kid?
As a kid, yeah. You mentioned Sterling, so let's have a look at, you know, that really turbulent week that he's had. I feel it's been incredibly unfair. There's been some appalling stuff written about him.
Yeah.
Why do we insist on putting so much pressure on someone who, as you've already said, is going to be a key player?
Yeah, I mean, I was embarrassed reading it. I was off last week, but I was following it and just thought I'd gone back 20, 30 years reading the coverage. I mean, there's a couple of things. There seems to be an appetite, and certainly this is what the public perceives. So whether we as journalists like it or not, there's a perception that we go for England players ahead of tournaments.
Build them up, knock them down.
Build them up, knock them down. And I think that is true. I don't think we can get away from that as a profession. I think there's maybe subtler reasons for that maybe the public don't understand. Maybe they think we've, as a profession, we've got agendas against people. I think it's just about selling newspapers. I think what happens before tournaments is it's a very quiet period. The Premier League's finished. Sports editors are just mad to get football stories, get them on the back page. And, you know, easiest story is somebody that's been on a pedestal, find something negative about them and do it. I'm not saying that's right, I'm just saying that's how the industry works. Mm. So I think there's that, but then there's a more unsavoury aspect of of the coverage of Sterling, which I think is, you can't, I don't want to use the word racism simply because racism, using that word tends to stop all debate, makes people react very strongly. But I thought there was a lot of stereotyping and bullying in the coverage that has been a factor in Raheem's whole career. And there does seem to be a section of people in our industry who have a problem with seeing a young, successful, confident black footballer doing well, but maybe expressing himself in ways that, I don't know, middle-aged white people don't quite understand, which is a difference in upbringing and culture and so on. And it expresses itself in a very nasty way in our press sometimes.
Mm. In a strange way, and, you know, you've been in enough dressing rooms to work this one out, David, it could be a unifying force, couldn't it? You know, I noticed, obviously, Gareth Southgate came out in his favour, but also you looked at the pictures from training. Sterling is centrepiece of it. They've got their arms around him. You know, that awful word banter is going on. Is that likely to happen, do you think? They'll all form a barrier around him.
You've seen that. There was a picture of them. I don't know where it came from, but I saw it on social media, and it was the full team, the, you know, the backroom staff and everyone, and everyone looked really relaxed. Mm. It doesn't look like there's any sort of, you know, we've been talking about Lampard, Ferdinand, Gerrard, and the cliques and the rivalries perhaps spoilt what could have been a great generation of footballers internationally. You can see that they're not like that. I know a few of the players, they're really sort of close off the pitch. They've known each other a few years and obviously played together, you know, like Trippier and Walker. And even Kyle Walker's social media, you know, as soon as that came out, you know, he was straight on there and he was backing his mate. And we know, you know, we've met the players and we've, you know, spoken to them privately. And the perception of footballers is often, well, more... most of the time, it's different from reality, you know. And someone like Raheem Sterling, you know, people see this young black kid with lots of money, and they just jump on him straight away. And it's not just the fact that in one off isolated incidents, people can see it, can defend it, but it's been a campaign. And not only that, the most worrying thing for me was that after the tattoo sort of you know, debate, it almost as if that was a signal to ramp it up again. So the next day, there's something else because we've got something here, rather than backing off from it, thinking, well, people think this is racist, it's wrong. It was just a signal for to ramp it up again, and that's what's troubling for me.
Mm. I think Gareth Southgate has handled it really well, and that's almost becoming a hallmark of his regime, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it allowed him to showcase, I think, one of his best qualities, which is. He's just a grown-up, sensible human being who he's intelligent, Gareth. So, and we were talking about this, Mike, but one of the problems in the Sterling coverage was people's inability to separate what's happening on a football pitch and what's there in someone's personal life. You know, you had columns that were trying to put together the fact he was late for training, late turning up, with the fact he has a tattoo, or you know, over the weekend, the fact he dived in a football match just somehow goes back to him having a tattoo, which is, you know, we've got to separate the personal and the football. And Gareth's very good at that. So I thought when he came out after the game against Nigeria, and he was honest and he said, look, I would have dropped him for being late. I was going to drop him. But then this happened, and then I had to back him. I think he helped separate things out for everybody, and I think he showed really good management, because on the one hand he also let Raheem Sterling know, you know, that it wasn't acceptable being late, but I'm also backing you. I think very, very sort of skillful, but it's not manufactured by Gareth. I think that's just how he is as a person. If you think about the crises he's had to deal with as an England manager, he's knocked them all back really easily,
and they've been big decisions taken decisively, aren't they?
There's one thing I didn't foresee myself saying at this junction in proceedings. Was when he came into the setup, I didn't think him being his manager would have been a strength and a real positive for England. And I think that it's turned out that way. You look around at all the other countries who have fired managers just before qualification. Yeah. You've got Sampaoli with Argentina, who doesn't know his best side. He's messing around with formations. Mm. Gareth's just—he's come in, and yeah, of course. At first, it seemed a bit of a beige, sort of safe option, but he seems to be bringing out, and the decisions he's making, you know, the hard decision, I didn't think he would make that decision. And it showed, that showed real strength.
Yeah. Do you think on that, I was just going to say, with Hart, the one thing we were speaking with Pickford, but it strikes me that Gareth's got a very good understanding of social dynamics as well. And you're talking about Pickford and his personality. By taking Hart out of the equation, he allows Pickford to be the number one in a peer group, which is a very different dynamic to if Pickford's there, but he's got, you know, this guy who's with a great England career, who's a senior pro, who's quite a strong character himself, kind of hanging about in the background. It's little things like that to me that show his intelligence, I think.
I think it's healthy in that situation to have a hierarchy. Now, whether there still has to be that that competition, which there will be. Every day, Jack Butlin will be wanting to prove himself and get himself in the side and try and be better than John Pickford every day in training. Nick Paul will be the same. But once you've got that hierarchy, then it's kind of like we can get on with things and we can help each other. Whereas with Joe Hart, I'm sure you would have done that. I'm sure you wouldn't have been a problem at all. But the way I see it is that him being there, he's just he's reminding people what could happen if things go wrong. That could be me, and that's been removed. So I think that's healthy for the three of them as well.
What's his most important decision before the World Cup, Johnny? Is it the defence?
I think it is. I mean, there's a couple of things. I think he hasn't quite got the wide positions right. If he really wants to make the most of a wing-back system, then obviously the wing-backs have to be as good as possible. And he may have to look at, I think the Ashley Young, Danny Rose is the biggest single kind of dilemma. Two people are quite equal, I guess. But Danny Rose is left-footed, which makes an enormous difference if you want to play that way. I think Alexander-Arnold might put some pressure on Trippier. I think he'll make his debut.
He's going to play on Thursday, isn't he?
Yeah, and we'll see how good he is. But I think the biggest thing to come out of the weekend was Gary Cahill's performance. It showed you that he is back to, you know, what he has been, which is a very good career. And the value of having someone that's just a bit more experienced in that back line. And John Stones, to me, who is a huge favourite of Gareth Southgate, he has not played well enough to justify a place in the England team at the World Cup, neither for England nor for Manchester City this season. We all know how good a footballer he is, but on form, he hasn't done it. So that's the one where Gareth, he may cop out and he might play both of them, but I think he had Harry Maguire earmarked for that left-sided centre-back role. So I think if he's really being tough, he chooses between Gary Cahill and Stones, and if he's choosing on form, he chooses Cahill.
Do you agree with that?
Before the game on Saturday, I'd have put Carl Walker, Eric Dyer, and John Stones in that back three. I think it's a difficult decision for whether, but if he's playing the one in front, whether it's going to be Henderson or Dyer. It looks like it could be Dyer, but I think Henderson's had a great second half of the season as well. You know, I think a lot of people complain about the things that he doesn't do instead of just concentrating on the job that he does for Liverpool. And he'd do that again for England. But you're right, Cahill's probably played himself in the side now Saturday, not just because he scored, but he looked solid. The only worry for me is that covering down that left-hand side, he's not natural going out and filling that space. So that's the only problem for me, really.
What about in midfield? Would you start Ruben Loftus-Cheek?
No, I wouldn't. Dele Alli's changed my mind, actually, in the last few months. I was frustrated with him early in the season, but I like him better as a number eight, attacking number eight, than a sort of number 10 who thinks he's, you know, Maradona or whatever, because he isn't. And he seemed to be getting a bit carried away with himself earlier on in the season. But back in that position where he can attack the box, but he can use his mobility and fill in spaces in midfield, I thought him and Lingard looked really good together. I think I was trying to remember the game where Ali and Ross Bartley played as two number eights, but whenever England have done it, it's worked really, really well. It's almost giving them the old box-to-box midfielder, but with some insurance behind them, which is what they never had back in the day. So I would play Ali there, and I would definitely play Lingard because he's been such an important cog in Gareth's sort of plans and probably deserves it. But Loftus-Cheek's not a bad option to bring on.
It's interesting, if you look, you know, we talked about looking at, you know, are they going to score enough goals? Kane, Ali, Lingard and Sterling, 91 goals between them. in the Premier League. At England level, they've only scored 25 in 17 matches under Gareth Southgate. Is that the area of worry as well?
Yeah, and I think the system, the only worry about the system is if they come up against sides who play a 4-3-3, so it makes our back three a back five, and I guess it's difficult then to get bodies forward. I agree what you say about about Dele Alli. Sometimes, especially on the season, he was playing right up next to to Harry Kane, and either the ball wasn't getting to him or there was no space for him to run into as well. So I think that's definitely where he should play. But it's just the lack of a real genuine sort of creative player who's who can create something out of nothing. Harry Kane, you know, give him the supply, he can score goals, but is he going to get something out of nothing? That's the only worry for me.
Yeah.
From deeper anyway.
I think that's right. That's a glaring problem with England, which is, it goes back to Sterling. I think it has to be Sterling's movement that does it. It has to be him picking up those little positions, because it's not going to come from a pass, is it?
And that's the worry. I mean, as good as Raheem Sterling's been this season, it's the reasons for that is because where it's come from.
Yeah.
It's come from a Silva, it's come from a De Bruyne. And it doesn't matter how good Raheem Sterling's movement is and his positions are, if the ball doesn't get to him, then it's...
Yeah, sure. You mentioned Harry Kane, you know, 8 goals in the last 7 internationals. So we can rely on him for a degree of goal-scoring ability. What about the other stuff, the external stuff, the captaincy? How do you think he will respond to that? Or does it really matter?
No, well, I think it does matter. We'd like to think it doesn't. I know the kind of hipster argument is that captaincy doesn't matter, and I go along with that to a certain extent. But sadly, it does, because they just get pressure thrown on them. They have to do, you know, just think, practically speaking, they have to do more press conferences. They have to sit alongside the manager. They have to be the social convener. So it is a job. It is a burden. And I know that Steven Gerrard felt drained after 2014 with all the duties that it involved. I think Harry Kane, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, he's quite a simple soul. You know, he plays his football. He doesn't worry about much. He's Harry Kane. And I think he'll take it easily. I don't think he overthinks things, put it that way. I don't think he'll worry about the pressure side of things quite so much. Mm. So for that reason, I think it's not a bad thing.
Because he's not going to be a sort of a Henry V at Agincourt figure, is he? He's
not
going to be giving it all this.
Do that. But nor is he going to, you know, fret or question himself. There's never been any sign of Harry Kane questioning himself on a football pitch, and that captaincy can make people do that.
Yeah,
as long as it doesn't affect him on the pitch. You know, there is all those duties you've got to do, but once you get out there, as long as you don't burden yourself with the responsibility of if it's your responsibility to win games, or if you lose, it's your fault. People can get saddled with that and the pressure, but. And it obviously makes it a lot easier if you've got other captains, other club captains in your side. I mean, just off the top of my head, you've probably got Henderson, who could be in there. Mm-hmm. Apart from that,
Cahill's captain, doesn't he? Yeah.
With the group, it's tempting to say it should be relatively straightforward, but we've all learned that actually with England, it's never straightforward, is it?
It's never straightforward. I mean, I think, no World Cup group is going to be easy. So if you look at all the groups and you try and place England in it, then probably apart from Russia's group, that it's as decent a draw as they could get. But I think what people need to be prepared for are 2 pretty grim opening games for England. Mm. You know, don't expect fireworks against Tunisia and Panama, because they're not going to allow it to happen.
First game, Tunisia,
is it's going to be a stinker.
It's going to be a 1-0, isn't it, if you're lucky.
It is, because they've organised, they're going to sit, they're going to try and break on England. They're going to create that. They're going to have that slightly different rhythm, that sort of South American rhythm of playing, which will be to slow the game down. And England need to be prepared to just be patient. And fans have got to be patient at home. You know, fans have got to be just accept that this might 1-0 is going to be a decent result, but it might be a 1-1, and England will have to win it in the Panama game.
Mm. You know, people talk about tournament teams, don't they? You know, we've always looked at Germany, for instance, as a team that grow into a tournament. As a player, what's the mindset going into, say, a month-long tournament? You know, are you looking to make that initial statement, or is it just a matter of building gradually?
It's a fine balance, isn't it? Because if you go into it hell for leather and you're spending a lot of energy on and getting through the early stages, then it's going to pay later on. I always say it like it's almost like Wimbledon. Mm. You know, you don't want to be going into five setters in the first few rounds, you know, but at the same time, you just, like I said, you've got to make sure that you're getting through those games. And if it's, you're right, if it's 1-0, you know, we should be over the moon with that, whether it's Panama or Tunisia or Belgium. It's it has to be a slow burn. It's very rarely you see teams like set or on fire. You know, they soon burn out sort of early in the knockout stages.
Mm. Look at Tunisia. Only conceded four goals in qualifying. Yep. So that tells you the nature of the team, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I mean, I think they're going to be similar to Algeria. In 2010.
Oh dear, that was a stinker,
it
was wasn't it?
It was awful. I mean, England will hopefully, you know, they'll be a bit more youthful and pacey than they were in that game, because that was, you know, peak Fabio, and not in a good way. Yeah. I mean, I think what Boufal's obviously a very skillful player. There's Kasri, who didn't really do that much for Sunderland, but has had a pretty decent career in France. As I say, they're going to be patient, they're going to sit, and then they're going to just try and get a little bit of magic from one of those players. And you know, they'll play with a lot of pride as well. Those North African teams, will like we saw with Algeria, they'll see England as a scalp.
Mm, mm. Did you see much of Kasri at Sunderland?
Yeah, did you? He's brilliant set pieces. He's obviously, Jordan Pickford will know a lot about him. Yeah. He'll know what to expect from him. But free kicks around the box, even from a corner,
right.
He often tries to score from a corner. I think he hit the post against Manchester United a couple of seasons ago. And
has Pickford not conceded from a corner?
There was one towards a back stick. Yeah. I can't remember which game it was. Yeah, but he'll know what to expect anyway. Yeah, but they're with Msakne, who's the big threat. Mm-hmm. So you know that's a big minus for them, and hopefully, you know, they won't have enough to trouble us defensively. But I still think that's the one big worry is Kasri's set pieces.
Mm. What about Belgium? Mm. I just got the suspicion, you look at it, are they less than the sum of its parts?
Yeah, this might be where the group flips for England, that the first two games might be harder than is thought, and Belgium might not be quite as daunting. Because, yeah, that's a good way to put it, they've got such great players. We look at, we know how good, attacking-wise, that, you know, Hazard and De Bruyne and you know, Lukaku and so on. But they've never really sparked together. They've never. I haven't seen a Belgium game, and I'm not saying I've watched all the games, but I've not seen De Bruyne and Hazard sort of sparking off each other, and you know, really looking like a lethal combination. Lukaku's developed a bit later as an international player. You know, in the last World Cup, he was behind Divock Origi. Mm. So yeah, he scored a lot of goals in qualifying, but against sort of Gibraltar and so on. They haven't beaten top teams under Martinez. I think they had a disappointing friendly result. They were booed off at the
0-0.
Yeah,
it's so, Portugal.
You know, you've got to worry about them. And going back to one thing we're saying about England's formation, Hazard has got the capabilities to really test England in the wide areas. Mertens as well. But they might be a bit of an England golden generation 2006. Kind of set up that they might not be as good as we think they are. Mm. And England might just need a draw out of that game.
Mm. What about Roberto Martinez? Does he convince you, David?
Well, more importantly, probably he doesn't convince the Belgian players. See that Kevin De Bruyne are coming out and saying that they haven't found the right system. He struggled in the side, certainly. So he's probably got a... Maybe not an extra grind, but he, you know, he wants to get the best out of himself, and he doesn't think Martinez is doing that. You see today on social media when the Belgian squad's released, all the comments underneath, not that my French is brilliant, but it's, you know, saying that they disagree with a lot of his selections.
Nainggolan was a popular player.
Yeah, exactly. People are unhappy that Dendonka's been included in the squad, and there just seems to be a lot of negativity around them. And, I mean, I'm not tempting fear, but I hope it continues.
Mm. Do you think they're the modern Holland?
Yeah, they could be. And they it's interesting that there's a bit of player discontent with Martinez, because it was the same with Wilmots. I think Hazard had his moments with Wilmots. He was pilloried by the press. Everyone got big opinions about the Belgian team, like they always did with Holland as well.
I think if you've got that many, individuals, yeah. great individuals, that, and they're all used to being the stars on their side, then if the manager isn't being accommodating to everything that they need, you're always going to get discontent. So you know, so last time it was Hazard, this time it's De Bruyne owned.
And it must be hard for Martinez if you've got Kevin De Bruyne, who's you know an acolyte now of Guardiola, who's got Guardiola coaching. It's always, anything after that is going to feel a little bit sort of second rate.
The fact that you know, Courtois, there's a lot of talk about him leaving. You know, Hazard, really, you know, the World Cup's a shop window. Chelsea's a club in flux because of Abramovich. How difficult is it? Will that play into it in as much as that there'll be distractions for them?
Yeah, Alderweireld as well, who's his future's you know, under threat. I think it does. I know there's an argument that the players will use it as a short window and all that kind of stuff. But there's a reason that one of the repeated stories you get in international meetups is that international manager A wants player to sort out future before game or tournament because it is a distraction.
Assuming England get through the group, then you've then got Poland, Japan, Senegal or Colombia, one of those four. You could do a lot worse than that, couldn't you?
You could, but I think Group H is probably the most interesting for me.
Yeah, it is,
It's probably the one I'm looking forward to seeing how it goes because Japan probably is the outsiders in the group, but I think the other three sides are much of a muchness. And you think Colombia, Senegal, you wouldn't want to face either of those. I mean, Senegal, they're full of players and established European clubs. A good manager as well. So it's a difficult one, and certainly Colombia with the players they have, James Rodriguez and Falcao. Yeah, you know you don't be facing any of those, I don't think.
But all roads lead to Germany.
Yeah, actually Germany have got their own problems. I think it looks like you know, we're talking about Sané not being included. It does look like Joachim Löw is very loyal, understandably, to his old guard. They've done so much in football, but you know, Mesut Ozil, Sami Khedira, even Hummels and so on. Are they at the level that they were 4 years ago? I'm sure they've got the hunger because these are top professionals. But are they just at the level? We've seen in their club careers that they might not be. So. You know, that German team, I think, needed the likes of Sané. I know they've got Goretzka, who's Kimmich. They have got young blood. But there's a danger that they'll just be a bit past the sell-by date. Still be England, though.
Yeah. But if it's not England, who's going to win the World Cup very quickly?
I'll go for Brazil.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think Brazil or Spain in the final, but probably Brazil.
Well, I've got a hunch it will be France. Youth, pace, adventure, and big players with something to prove. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.